approach to growth, development, and social progress. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking at the Mark Twain House in Hartford, Connecticut, Monday, July 21st at 7 p.m. and Martha's Vineyard, Saturday, July 26th, 7 p.m. at Catherine Cornell Auditorium in Vineyard Haven. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Stu Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield, Hameen Gibbon, with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5 o'clock straight up. Stay tuned for the Thursday evening news coming up after this message.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 34th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 18th to Sunday, July 20th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, the oldest continual free jazz festival west of the Mississippi River. This year, Friday night will be a blues night featuring the Roseland Hunters, and the rest of the festival features jazz performers Farrell Newton plus Soul 3, the Portland Youth Jazz Orchestra, the Mel Brown Septet, Devin Phillips, and many more. Again, that's the 34th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, located in Cathedral Park under the St. John's Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, after more than a week of conflict marked by rocket attacks and artillery bombardments, the Israeli army has launched a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip with the stated aim of destroying Hamas's infrastructure.
Controversial police captain Mark Krueger, right here in Portland, won a settlement from the city of Portland, erasing his disciplinary record and reimbursing him for 80 hours of suspension that he received because he erected a tribute to Nazi-era German soldiers here in a city park.
And residents of Portland's East Moreland neighborhood staged a protest this morning using their cars to block the demolition of an historic home.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 17th, 2014. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Lisa Loving. This morning, members of the East Moreland Neighborhood Association blocked access to a 1949 ranch house that was scheduled for demolition. Led by Association President Robert McCullough, residents parked their cars along Southeast Rural Street to keep demolition equipment from approaching the house and confronted Randy Sebastian, the president of Renaissance Homes, which owns the property and applied for the demolition. The protest was sparked by the developer's use of a loophole in land use law, which states when a developer tears down one house to build two or more, they must give 30 days notice. When residents in East Moreland requested a 120-day delay, Renaissance Homes submitted a new demolition request stating they would only be building one home. However, the developer does plan to build two homes on the plot, but one at a time, circumventing the land use law. For more on the protest, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke to Robert McCullough, president of the East Moreland Neighborhood Association.
Robert, can you give me some background on this demolition loophole that was used by Renaissance Homes?
Well, actually, it's a new one. It just popped up in the last few days. Under the law, if you decide to split a property and build multiple homes, the neighborhood has the right to comment, and they can ask for a delay in order to comment. On July 8th, we asked for that delay, and it was granted. Yesterday at 4 p.m., the neighbors found out that the property was going to be demolished today. That, of course, contradicted the delay we'd just been granted by the city. But what we found is a new interpretation. Apparently, there's never a time in which you build multiple homes because you build them one by one. So this argument is sort of a ping pong. They applied for two homes. Then they explained they were only building one home. But Renaissance Homes is very honest about the plan to build two. Their argument is that they're just building them one by one, so the law no longer counts. We obviously think that might be a fairly unlikely interpretation, and I told Renaissance Homes that we would be taking that to court. It's also very clear that the city's process here was to take a reasonable solution where we could talk it through, make some changes and everyone leave happy, and pursue a conflict. The logic of it is pretty bewildering. It's sort of a let's you and him fight. I once said to Charlie Hales, living in the city that works is a lot of work. And this is yet another case where the city is choosing to create complexity and conflict instead of just fixing things. But the good news is we had three TV trucks, helicopters, a lot of neighbors, a lot of cars. And I shook hands with Renaissance Homes to work through some of these issues over the next week. We've got a pretty powerful land use committee here with architects and scholars and lawyers. And as I said to Renaissance Homes, this is going to be the cheapest consulting you ever paid for. So I'm upbeat that we can make some changes that will make it a better city. But the one thing I will tell you is, for all the people that were here this morning, and there were a lot, one person that was not here was Amanda Fritz or her staff. They didn't call us. They didn't engage us. They didn't even do us the courtesy of telling us that they had reinterpreted city law out of the blue and without, as far as I can see, the least justification. So
that this is a, when did this rule go into effect?
Well, it's a rule that's not written down anywhere. So apparently yesterday at 4 o'clock.
Huh. Is there a considerable amount of development down there in Eastmoreland going on?
Yes, we've had quite a few demolitions and rebuilds. It's hard to count because under Portland City Code, anything is a remodel. We laugh here in the neighborhood that around December we get to celebrate the Pearl Harbor remodel. So if you can't make any of the other loopholes, you can just pretend that the bulldozer driving through the house is remodeling, and we've seen that. Most of the demolitions have led to McMansions. The city says it's infill, but the fact of the matter is, developer buys an older, smaller house, puts up a larger house, knocks down the trees, eliminates the lawn so they can get the largest possible floor space. Free country, that's an argument. We would, of course, prefer that we maintain the trees and maintain the grass. And so that's part of the debate we'll be having with Renaissance Homes this week.
But what agreement was reached this morning?
The head of Renaissance Homes and I shook hands on a week to talk this through and see if we can find changes that we both agreed to.
And instead of the 120 days, it's now just 7 days?
It's just 7. But we, of course, never needed 120. We're going to find out whether we can agree or not. And if we can't agree, then there may be further legal action at the end of it. But my objective is not to go into the legal business. My objective is to protect middle-class neighborhoods so that there are trees and flowers and lawns and kids playing, all the other parts of Portland as we like it. What I don't want to see is a lot of cement and a real change in our lifestyle. That's because we live in Portland. We believe in land use law. We believe in environmentalism.
All right. Robert, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Robert McCullough, president of the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association.
And in the Roseway neighborhood in East Portland, residents have pushed back against developers looking to open a new drive-through pharmacy on Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Last week, residents learned of plans to demolish the Rose City Nazarene building and put a Walgreens in its place. The new pharmacy would be right across the street from a Safeway pharmacy and one block away from Fairley's pharmacy. Members of the community have been fighting to create the kind of walkable and locally owned neighborhood that Portland celebrates. According to residents, the new Walgreens would do nothing to meet the needs of the neighborhood. Neighbors have started mobilizing through social media, through contacting planners, and appealing to other businesses, such as New Seasons, to use the site instead.
Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum today filed a lawsuit against Living Essentials and Innovation Ventures, the makers of the energy drink 5-Hour Energy. The suit, filed in Multnomah Circuit Court, says the companies repeatedly violated the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act by making deceptive and misleading claims about their 5-Hour Energy products. The suit alleges the company used print, television, internet, and radio advertising to claim 5-Hour Energy contains a unique blend of ingredients that provide consumers with energy, alertness, and focus, when in reality, the only ingredient that provides any effect is the concentrated dose of caffeine. The lawsuit also targets allegedly misleading claims that the product has been recommended by doctors in a way that it has not, and that the product is appropriate for adolescents over 12. 5-Hour Energy has sold at over 100,000 retail locations through the United States. Quote, "This lawsuit is about requiring truth in advertising," said Rosenblum. "Plainly and simply, in Oregon, you cannot promote a product as being effective if you don't have sufficient evidence to back up your advertising claims."
Today, the number of large wildfires burning in the Northwest region has risen to 21. Recent lightning storms have sparked the latest fires. This has forced hundreds of people to evacuate their homes. In Washington, Chewakum Creek Fire was detected Tuesday, about 10 miles north of Leavenworth. This fire has burned through more than 1,200 acres. Up to 400 people have been told to leave their homes, and another 800 houses have been declared as threatened by the fire. Oregon's Moccasin Hill Fire near Sprague River has turned out to be more destructive than it was first reported as. The number of homes destroyed has risen from 6 to 17, with 16 outbuildings also destroyed. The governors of both the states of Oregon and Washington have declared a state of emergency in order to free up state resources to fight these fires. So far, a total of 80,000 acres have been burned in Oregon and Washington's 21 large wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives voted yesterday to make banks more accessible to marijuana-related businesses. The vote stopped a move by Republican Representative John Fleming of Louisiana to prevent the Treasury Department from following new guidelines on banking with legal pot shops. Federal law makes it difficult for banks to do business with marijuana dispensaries in states where pot is legal. Banks could be accused of helping pot shops launder money because it's still a federal crime to sell marijuana. Reluctance to bank with pot-related businesses has forced many shop owners to stockpile cash, which makes the money harder to track and raises the potential for robberies and marijuana dispensaries. The Treasury Department already issued guidance in February to help banks confidently deal with legal marijuana operations. However, the vote on Wednesday represents a shift in anti-marijuana sentiment among members of Congress.
Also in cannabis here in the U.S., a new law has come into effect yesterday, decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana in the District of Columbia. This follows the expiration of a congressional review period about this issue. The law has the overwhelming approval of the District of Columbia Council, and it was signed by the mayor, Vincent C. Gray, in March. This new law will make the penalties for marijuana possession in the nation's capital among the lowest in the country. The district's arrest rate, however, for marijuana possession is higher than any of the 50 states, according to a report released in June by the American Civil Liberties Union. African Americans account for 91% of marijuana possession arrests in the Washington, D.C. area and were 8 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than whites. The ACLU's analysis concluded that enforcing marijuana possession laws, which make up nearly half of all drug offenses, costs the district more than $26.5 million every year. The new law replaces criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana with a civil fine of $25, which is similar to a parking ticket. The new law also removes penalties for possession of paraphernalia in conjunction with small amounts of marijuana. Also, it specifies that individuals cannot be searched or detained based solely on an officer's suspicion of marijuana possession. Public use of marijuana will remain a criminal offense in D.C., punishable by up to 60 days in jail and a fine of up to $500.
And now we turn to our friends at nativenews.net for the top headlines from a Native American perspective.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new app has been developed to help Alaska Native students learn the Chupik language. KYUK's Charles Enoch reports.
You may not have heard about the Chupik language since it hasn't been in the mainstream, at least until now. It's something you might learn about when you download a version of the Mili Mali storybook series. That's from the story Mili Mali and Bertie, or in this case, Milik Malik Apakchoklu in Chupik, voiced by Rebecca Nayaman, Ignatius Chayelkun, and Lillian Olson. Dr. Robert Wicker is the director for the Consortium for Digital Learning of the Association of Alaska School Boards. He says they're looking for ways to preserve and maintain Alaska Native languages.
Now we have 20 Alaska Native languages, some on the verge of disappearing.
The association awarded an Innovation in Language grant to the Kasunamit School District for this project. The Kasunamit School District is a single-site school district for Chivak, Alaska, one of two villages along the Bering Sea where Chupik is still spoken. Wicker and the other members of the association traveled to Chivak to assist with the recording, but ultimately decided they would save time and money by producing it at a location better suited for such a project.
We saw real quickly this was going to take a long time. We decided we should send the three speakers to the New Zealand recording studios. I just think it was a very heroic trip. People were basically traveling halfway across the world to preserve their language for their children.
With some hard work, it only took 4 days to record the translations, and after 3 months, the apps were published. Along with the 12 books in the Mili Mali series, two more books narrated and illustrated by Alaska Native students are now available on the App Store. To check these apps out, type out any variation of the word Chupik, C-U-P-I-K, into the iTunes Store search bar. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Disney's new animated film about a crew fighting wildfires includes a Native American character.
The one that Lakota called Heoka beats his drum with the wind to make thunder. With thunder comes lightning. And with lightning comes fire.
I don't hear any drums.
Shh.
Featured in that movie trailer for Planes, Fire and Rescue is Wind Lifter, a heavy lift helicopter voiced by actor Wes Studi.
What he brings to it, of course, is all of his baggage, all of his ways of thinking, and his culture background, of course, is what defines him and how he deals with his teammates, and also defines what he contributes, what he brings to the table.
Disney writers created Wind Lifter from research about Native American culture and Native fire crews. Wind Lifter is not identified as being from a specific tribe, yet Studi says having a Native character in the film is valuable.
We as American Indians kind of are always fighting the concept that we are people of the past, because unfortunately there is the concept that somehow we were all wiped off the face of the earth, and unless we dress in feathers, leathers on a contemporary basis, nobody understands who we are. We're just another set of brown people that showed up. Who are they? Are they immigrants? We're not immigrants. We were perhaps immigrants long ago, but we were here when you got here, is what we can say to the general public.
Wind Lifter, you're clear to maneuver.
Wind Lifter copies.
Mr. Mayday. Planes, Fire and Rescue opens this week nationwide. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Not voting is not rebelling, it's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org. Brought to you by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The Microsoft Corporation says it's cutting 18,000 jobs over the next few months in a bid to become more competitive with its rivals in mobile phone and software manufacturing. This would be almost 14% of its total workforce, which is headquartered right here in Redmond, Washington, in the Northwest. The move came after the corporation bought out part of Nokia, the Finland-based cell phone maker. Most of the cuts will be of Nokia employees, according to Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella. Nadella took over the company from Stephen Ballmer earlier this year. And observers say that it had been Ballmer's idea in the first place to expand into cell phone hardware manufacturing.
Activists plan to use Twitter to challenge Twitter on workforce inclusion and diversity in a campaign set to start tomorrow at the Netroots Nation Conference in Detroit. Reverend Jesse Jackson, the Rainbow Push Coalition and Color of Change announced the campaign as part of their ongoing digital inclusion initiative launched last March. So far, the coalition has led Google, Yahoo, LinkedIn, and Facebook to post their diversity and hiring data for the first time. Organizers say Intel, HP, Microsoft, and Cisco already post their staff racial demographics online. Pandora, eBay, and Apple say they will release their diversity statistics soon. The Netroots Conference is the nation's largest convention of political progressives who organize for social change online. It was started 12 years ago by staff from the Daily Kos. Activists say the goal of the Twitter campaign is to mobilize hundreds of thousands of Twitter subscribers, demanding that Twitter release its employer information report filed with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. They're also calling for a direct dialogue with Bay Area community partners on strategies to desegregate the digital workforce. On Friday, Color of Change plans a Black Twitter plenary session where activists will push the petition campaign over Twitter and social media. Overall, the data that is available shows a vast majority of staff members in the tech industries are white and male.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the city's settlement with controversial police captain Mark Krueger, who will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be very much like today. It'll be clear and sunny with a high of about 82, a low of about 62. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 29 counts permitted in North Portland, with spikes up to 55. 28 counts permitted in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 38 CPM. Hanford, Washington has a count of 35 CPM. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 36 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information on this can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, Bolsheviks executed Tsar Nicholas and his family at Yekaterinburg in 1918. And in 1936, 18 years later, in Spain, an armed forces rebellion against a recently elected leftist government sparked the Spanish Civil War. The quote of the day is from Billie Holiday. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
It's 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Can you have your hypocrisy and eat it too? I don't think so, but Cargill Inc. is doing its damnedest to get away with its version of the old admonition that eating your cake today means not having it tomorrow. Cargill, the $2.3 billion a year food conglomerate, is a huge producer and user of food ingredients that contain genetically manipulated organisms. But it has a marketing problem. By huge margins, consumers here and around the world do not want to put those GMO frankenfoods on their families' tables. Thus, Cargill has been a ferocious, deep-pocket opponent of every state law and ballot initiative that would mandate the labeling of any product containing GMOs. Better that families be kept in the dark about what they're buying and eating, says Cargill. Better for its profits, that is. Indeed, the chairman of the conglomerate's board is also on the executive committee of the industry lobbying front that goes all out to kill every right-to-know provision for consumers. Any such label, he scolds, would be, quote, misleading. But whoa, what's this? It's a press release from Fortress Cargill, proclaiming that the diehard giant is now marketing a non-GMO soybean oil that, voila, announces on its label that the product is GMO-free. Has the diehard had a change of heart? Excuse me, but corporations don't have hearts. They have bottom lines, period. And the bottom line is that Cargill's terminally hypocritical honchos see dollars laying on the ground that they're not getting. So, weasels a company man with a cumbersome title of Food Ingredients Commercial Manager, quote, despite the many merits of biotechnology, consumer interest in non-GMO ingredients is growing, creating opportunities for food manufacturers. This is Jim Hightower saying, that is the clearest expression you'll ever get of corporate integrity.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The Scanner News reported today that a coalition of civil rights activists are calling on the Federal Department of Justice to investigate the Washington State Corrections Department concerning its dismal hiring record for people of color. A dozen activists gathered in Seattle to call on U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate why the state's prison system only employs a total of 3 people of color in its administrative services division out of a total of 39 administrative officials. The community leaders also demanded an investigation into why Corrections has systematically failed to post job openings or hire from outside the system. Instead, they use direct appointments to fill high-level jobs. The letter to Holder reads, quote, "A culture of institutional racism has become systemic and experienced at all levels in this state agency." Renton County Councilor Greg Taylor says that Washington's initiative, number 200, passed in 1998 to prohibit the use of racial quotas in hiring, is the culprit in bad job numbers in this area.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Commerce Department is proceeding with the United Steelworkers trade case against China. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard says the union is pleased that its complaint aimed at achieving fair trade with China on passenger vehicle and light-duty truck tires is moving forward. The USW is alleging illegal dumping of the tires. From 2011 to 2013, China doubled its share of the U.S. tire market from 9 to 18%. The union says China is using massive illegal dumping to gain market share by selling tires below cost. The U.S. International Trade Commission will vote on that trade case July 22nd. The United Auto Workers Union has begun signing up more members to the newly formed UAW Local 42 at VW's Chattanooga, Tennessee plant. The charter members of the new UAW Local, which uses the legendary Jackie Robinson baseball uniform number 42, say they're confident of quickly getting to a majority. Shortly after the UAW announced the formation of Local 42, VW publicly announced a new vehicle coming to the plant. VW is investing $900 million and will add 2,000 jobs. That puts the lie to anti-union politicians' arguments sense that the presence of the UAW would mean the new vehicle would be built elsewhere. VW also said Monday that Bernd Osterloh, chair of the VW Worker Council, will become a director of Volkswagen Group of America. UAW Secretary Treasurer Gary Castile says a cornerstone of VW's successful world business model is employee representation and participation in VW's Global Works Council. As unions like AFSCME are attacked, they evolve and develop new tactics and strategies to defeat the anti-union attacks. Matt Bublitz of Fall River, Wisconsin, is attending AFSCME's Chicago convention this week.
Well, I think right now it's just a matter of rebuilding and reorganizing and restructuring. You know, a lot of states besides Wisconsin have taken a lot of hits, public employees. It's a matter of finding ourselves again and rebuilding, taking a lot of the youth that are coming into a lot of these public jobs and not understanding the union, bring them into that culture and explain to them why it's important. I urge anybody that knows a union member, just sit down and talk with them about it. Grab a beer, sit down, talk about the union. You know, it's a lot different than the spin you hear on TV or the radio ads about us being thugs and everything else. I'm your next door neighbor, man.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein says the announcement by Staples that it's ending its outsourcing deal with the U.S. Postal Service is a ruse. Postal worker unions have been campaigning against the Staples deal because it replaces experienced, well-compensated postal workers with lower-wage, non-union, inexperienced workers to deliver some postal services at Staples stores. The APWU says Staples and the USPS are changing the name of the program without addressing the fundamental concerns of postal workers and customers. The 1.2 million member American Federation of Teachers this week announced its support for the postal union's Staples boycott. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Responding to reports that NSA and FBI officials may have used the ethnic slur raghead in surveillance programs targeting American Muslims, the Sikh Coalition today filed a Freedom of Information Act request with both agencies demanding to see all employee emails since September 11th of 2001 that contain the anti-Sikh epithets raghead and or towelhead. Since the 9/11 attacks, Sikh Americans have repeatedly endured violence and bigotry because of their religiously mandated turbans. In August of 2012, a gunman with known ties to neo-Nazi groups attacked a Sikh house of worship in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. He killed six worshipers and injured several others, including a local law enforcement officer. In the months after this massacre, a Sikh business owner was shot and injured in Port Orange, Florida. An elderly Sikh man was beaten with a steel rod in Fresno, California, and a Sikh professor was assaulted in New York City. Given the persistence of hate violence against Sikh Americans, and after a lengthy campaign by the Sikh Coalition, civil rights groups, and numerous members of Congress, the FBI finally agreed in 2013 to begin tracking hate crimes against the Sikhs. Amardeep Singh, program director of the Sikh Coalition, says, "The Sikh Coalition will not tolerate the use of racial or religious slurs by people who are supposed to protect us. We therefore demand a full accounting of NSA and FBI emails to determine the extent to which agency employees are combating bigotry, not promoting it."
A Malaysian passenger jet was shot down over eastern Ukraine this morning, killing all 295 people on board. The aircraft took off from Amsterdam and was bound for Kuala Lumpur when Malaysia Airlines lost contact with it near the Russia-Ukraine border. Reports indicate the plane was shot down by a ground-to-air missile, but so far no one has claimed responsibility. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko stressed the armed forces of the Ukraine took no action against airborne targets. He said the crash was an act of terrorism. A separatist leader based in Ukraine's eastern city of Donetsk also said his forces took no action against the plane, claiming they don't have weapons that could reach that altitude. The White House reports Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Obama discussed the crash over the telephone. Obama said his first priority is finding out whether there were any Americans aboard the plane. He said the United States would offer any assistance to help determine what happened and why. Ukraine's Interior Ministry later confirmed 23 American citizens are among the dead.
It is currently Thursday night in Israel, and Israel has launched an extensive ground offensive into the Gaza Strip aimed at significantly beating back the Hamas forces currently controlling the territory. The escalation comes after 10 days of intense conflict between Israel and Palestine in Gaza, which has killed 230 Palestinians, including 39 Palestinian children. Also, one Israeli has been killed. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stated that the offensive is meant to be limited, and it is in response to the discovery of tunnels leading from Gaza to Israel, allowing Hamas militants to cross the border. Bombardment from Israeli military jets, ships, and artillery installations along the border began again in the evening after a brief five-hour ceasefire, which had been requested by the United Nations in order to allow humanitarian aid to both reach injured Palestinians and to allow residents to go outside to markets and banks. It is unclear how long the new offensive will last, although Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman hinted at a potentially long campaign. And now, the latest news and developments prior to this invasion from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, July 17th, 2014. At least 237 Palestinians are killed as Israel continues its military offensive targeting the civilians in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. At least 15 civilians, including five children, were killed by Israeli aerial bombardment targeting the Gaza Strip on Thursday. Seven Palestinians were killed on Thursday afternoon when Israeli airstrikes began after a five-hour pause to allow humanitarian supplies to enter Gaza. Three children, Furla Tariq Shahaber, 8, Jihad Shahaber, 10, his brother Wasim, 9, were killed when Israeli bombs hit their family home in Gaza City on Thursday afternoon. In Khan Yunis, Israeli airstrikes targeted the home of Al-Jubur family, killing Rafat Khalil Al-Jubur, 4. In the meantime, Yasin Al-Hammoudi, 4, died of wounds sustained in an earlier airstrike on a home in Gaza City. In another attack on Thursday, Israeli warplanes and tanks bombarded the Al-Wafa hospital in Gaza just 10 minutes after a phone call from the Israeli military ordered the staff to evacuate all those in the hospital. On Wednesday, an Israeli naval ship fired multiple artillery shells at children on Gaza Beach, killing four children from Bekir family between the ages of 9 and 11. The attack happened near a beach hotel where foreign journalists are staying. The Israeli bombardment were focused on Thursday at residential areas in Gaza City, Khan Yunis in the south and Beit Hanun north of Gaza Strip, Palestinian sources reported. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza announced that the death toll due to the Israeli offensive have now reached 237, with 1,770 injured. Israel started its attacks on the coastal enclave last Tuesday. Earlier on Thursday, Israeli officials have agreed to temporarily halt the assault on Gaza after UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Robert Seri, called for a humanitarian ceasefire. The UN demanded Hamas and Israel to ceasefire to allow the entry of humanitarian supplies. From their part, Hamas agreed to a six-hour humanitarian truce to allow humanitarian supplies into Gaza. The ceasefire took effect on Thursday between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. local time. However, Israel resumed bombardment just minutes after the calm period was over. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, July 17th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Bassam Badnoura.
Tomorrow, there will be an emergency protest held at Senator Merkley's office right here in Portland in response to the Israeli offensive into Gaza. It will be held at 1:30 p.m. at Southwest First and Salmon. The protest is organized by Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, while presidential elections are underway, Taliban fighters have made a deadly attack on the Kabul International Airport. The attack occurred this morning, and although four of the people involved were killed, there were no civilian deaths or injuries. The recent violence underscores the instability of Afghanistan despite the current election. Candidates, former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai and former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah are in their second round of elections due to allegations of fraud in the first round.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Henry Alicia, Jennifer Kemp, Ethan Martin, and Lisa Loving. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Sakrina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. Or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue that you've heard about on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers if you have a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, guest host Joe Uris looks back at the founding of the U.S. and how imperialism is a continuous thread in our history. At 9, on Veterans Voice, Marvin, Bill, and Angie speak with Scott Olson, a Gulf War veteran who was seriously injured by Oakland police during a rally for Occupy. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with local activist Rachel Townsend and her husband Danny Cavedo, who is from Honduras, about the situation in Honduras and how it related to the children coming to the U.S. fleeing violence in their home countries. And a correction, tonight at 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland. Host Sequoia Wright is speaking with organizers of the Oregon Black Museum. And stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, including a discussion with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the continuing saga of controversial police captain Mark Krueger.
Good night, Lisa.
Good night.
Good night, Sequoia.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Thank you for listening to the news. This is KBOO In Depth. My name is Ethan Martin. Portland Police Captain Mark Krueger has had his record cleared of disciplinary measures taken against him after being suspended in 2010 for publicly posting a commemorative plaque honoring Nazi soldiers in a city park. Captain Mark Kruger was also found to be out of policy with the police department after retaliating against a female subordinate lieutenant in 2014. The city agreed to settle with Kruger after he threatened a defamation of character lawsuit. In addition to having his disciplinary record washed, Kruger will be awarded $5,000 in legal damages and given an additional 80 hours paid vacation time. City officials apparently took action to settle with Kruger without the knowledge of either Mayor Charlie Hales or City Commissioner Steve Novick, both of whom have come out in opposition to the settlement. The city's decision to award Kruger comes just as a training retreat meant to improve diversity and multicultural skills amongst Portland's largely white male police force draws to a close on Mount Hood. I spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland's Cop Watch for more on the story.
I'm Dan Handelman. I'm a member of Portland Cop Watch. I helped co-found the group in 1992.
We're kind of wanting to talk about the recent developments with Portland Police Captain Mark Kruger and his kind of being retroactively having some disciplinary actions taken off of his record. And so I was just wondering if you could talk about the timeline of events that have led to the situation now, beginning with Kruger's actions in 1999.
Right. Well, way back then, Captain Kruger was, I don't remember what his rank was at that point, he was just still an officer back then, and he went out into the woods in Portland and nailed up a plaque honoring basically some Nazi soldiers, which he later claimed was part of his fascination with World War II as an enthusiast, and there was a picture that surfaced of him dressed up in a Nazi uniform, and he said this just because he's interested in history. And those plaques had come to the attention of an attorney who was suing the police for violence that was perpetrated in a protest in either 2002 or 2003, I can't remember which, where Kruger was one of the people perpetrating violence. And the city denied that there was any such thing. But then it turned out that the city attorney had the plaques. A formal internal investigation a couple of years ago turned up those plaques in the city attorney's office, and Kruger was found guilty of bringing ill repute upon the bureau. And he was suspended for 80 hours and forced to go through basically multicultural sensitivity training. And along the way, he'd been promoted up the line, and I think that by this point he was a captain, despite the violence in those protests and despite the Nazi plaque and all that. So then, just a couple of years ago, Kruger had a person working under him who was not happy with the way she was being treated, and so she was trying to complain to his superior, who was Mike Kuykendall, a non-sworn assistant chief of the Bureau at that point, and also, by the way, a bandmate of Chief Reese. So, Kuykendall had an in to be part of the Bureau when he was hired in from the outside. And in their text messaging back and forth with each other, Lieutenant Galvin, who was a probationary lieutenant at the time, and Assistant Chief Kuykendall, such as it was, made jokes about the fact that Kruger had inclinations about Nazism. Hmm. And somehow he got a hold of these text messages, and he filed a complaint about both the assistant chief and the lieutenant. She ended up getting demoted. Kuykendall ended up resigning. And Ms. Galvin's original complaint against Kruger was investigated, and it was found that he was not inappropriately treating her inappropriately or harassing her. So when that decision came down, he pinned the notification of his being cleared of any wrongdoing onto his office door and wrote her name in big red ink on it, even though the letter didn't say the name of the person who had accused him. So basically he broke confidentiality by doing that. So I know this is a very confusing story, but Sergeant Galvin found out about that letter being posted up, she filed a complaint about that. And that complaint originally was basically put on the down, it was trotted down by the highest ranks of the Bureau, including the chief, as saying, well, that doesn't really rise to the level of misconduct. The Independent Police Review Division got involved, did their own investigation, handed the investigation over to the Bureau, and Captain Kruger was found out of policy, apparently, for pinning up Galvin's name. It was a form of retaliation.
Right.
So he was found out of policy, so both for putting up those plaques and for posting up this letter. So yesterday, Wednesday, July 16, the city council was considering a ordinance on their council agenda, which awarded former Sergeant Galvin, who's since left the Bureau, $50,000 for the trouble that all of this caused her, and particularly with the last piece of her name being nailed up by her former captain. And many of us who read the city council agenda thought this was the end of it, but it turned out, according to the Oregonian's website, that at the same time the city agreed a settlement with Captain Kruger, awarding him $5,000, which is a significant amount, and I'll tell you why, giving him back the money that he'd been denied for the 80-hour suspension for tacking up those plaques, removing the two findings from his file, and replacing him with a letter of commendation, which is very unusual and quite shocking when you think about the things he not only was accused of, what he was proven to have done. The $5,000 is significant because that is the threshold for a settlement to have to go to city council. If it's $5,000 and 1 cent, city council would have had to vote on it. But because it was $5,000, it didn't go before all of city council. So that's why nobody knew about this. And apparently Commissioner Novick expressed his outrage this morning.
So they awarded him the maximum amount of money without going over the threshold that would allow, or that would force the rest of the city kind of to become aware of the situation. What do you think their reasoning behind keeping it kind of on the lowdown is?
Well, your guess is as good as mine, but really, you know, this is on the tail end of a weekend where the chief and the mayor and several of the other higher-ranking police officials, but not Captain Kruger, went on this retreat for white men to talk about white male privilege and, you know, specifically things around discrimination against people of color, gays and lesbians, you know, who were discriminated against by the Nazis, and against women, which is what Kruger was accused of by Galvin in the first place. And to find out that right after this, you know, enlightening retreat, that this captain's file with these transgressions is being wiped off the record and he's being given money, it just sort of blows my mind. It raises the question, you know, and this is also just about a month and a half ago, an arbitrator ruled that who was the former captain of the traffic division, Todd Wyatt, who had been demoted for sexually harassing his underlings and for a road rage incident that he was engaged in when he was off duty, that the arbitrator ordered the city to re-promote him back to captain, saying that, yes, he did those things, but he was publicly humiliated by being demoted. So now we have this kind of situation where it seems like the city is willfully putting people who have these really bad judgment calls, and particularly around women and people of color, and you know, whatever else you might say about the Nazis, in high-ranking positions and leaving them there, regardless of what they do.
Well, has Police Chief Mike Reese come out and spoken to kind of the seeming inconsistency of hosting a kind of diversity retreat and then on the other hand, these actions by city officials to kind of award kind of known problem officer around those issues? Has Mike Reese said anything about this, or is it just too soon?
I haven't read anything that came out from the chief. You know, the letter of commendation was written by the mayor, is my understanding, I believe. I should double check that.
The letter of commendation is yet to be written by the mayor, or it already has?
It was already there. It was put into his file to replace... No, it actually was the chief who wrote the complimentary letter.
Okay. Because, I've heard, I know that City Commissioner Steve Novick is very outraged by this turn of events, and Mayor Charlie Hale seems to be not in support of it. But could you speak to their kind of positions on the situation? Do you think they're more outraged because they were not informed, or do you think they disagree with the kind of awarding of
the $5,000 settlement? I would think would have had to go through the mayor's office to be approved. It's still, even if the other members of city council didn't have to say anything about it because it didn't reach the threshold, I think the mayor's office would have had to sign off on it. So I haven't read anything about Mayor Hales. You sounds like you know more than I do, but if he's outraged about it, it means there's even more problems with this whole process than I thought.
I also read that Kruger threatened legal action, and that was one of the reasons why this even came up, and because he was threatening potentially sue the city.
So that's the settlement with him that included the $5,000 and the 80 hours. And when I said back pay, if they had actually awarded him pay, it would have had to go to city council, I think. But because they awarded it in the form of vacation hours, I think that's how they avoided a city council discussion. But yes, the reason there was a settlement with him was that he was suing them for defamation of character, which is kind of funny when you think about somebody who's nailed up a plaque talking about how great certain Nazi soldiers were.
Right.
Being upset about his character being defamed.
I'm curious as to how, just merely based on the threat of legal action, the city officials seemed so easy to kind of roll over and award him when there doesn't really seem to be a lot of support for such a decision. It seems like somebody, you know, or members of the city council are okay with kind of protecting and supporting someone like this. Could you speak to that possibility at all?
It's very hard to speculate what's going on behind closed doors. But institutionally speaking, you know, it doesn't surprise me because when you see what police do to people in the community on a daily basis, there's racial profiling going on, and there's certainly all sorts of discrimination. And the bureau itself is made up of, I think it's 80% male, and about that percentage of white people as well. So it kind of is reflective of a institution that is not very well set up to push out somebody who has problems with women or with minorities or maybe a Nazi sympathizer. And hopefully the changes that we're hearing about, that like this diversity retreat, hopefully those are sincere and that they're trying to make changes about them. But it's very hard to tell from being outsiders looking in what's really going on behind closed doors.
Yeah. So do you feel that this turn of events is consistent with previous kind of patterns of police discipline in that they, a lot of times, issues come up and they are either swept under the rug or they are mildly disciplined but not to the extent that would be appropriate? Yeah, does this seem kind of like just par for the course as it's been in the past? Or
It both is and it isn't. It is par for the course because most of the time when the officers who were found out of policy for killing James Chassis were actually found out of policy only because they didn't bring him to the hospital after they used a taser on him, and not because they killed him. And then the officer who shot Kendra James was suspended but not fired, but then his suspension was overturned. There's an officer who shot a man, a lieutenant who shot a man in front of his sister's house, you know, after breaking out of his own precinct to do it, and then he was found, you know, his conviction was overturned. And on and on. I mean, just like any time there's Officer Frashauer who shot Aaron Campbell in the back, right? He was fired and he was forced to be rehired by an arbitrator. What's unusual about this situation, why it's different, is that nobody forced the city to reverse these two findings against Captain Kruger or to put a letter of commendation. And this was something that was negotiated by attorneys that the city hired, and an agreement was made to do this. It was not done by a third party, like an arbitrator. So I find that to be particularly discouraging.
That was Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. Thanks, Dan, for doing this interview with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Ethan Martin, and you are listening to KBOO News.
You are indeed listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59, and next we have Rose City Native Radio. Tonight we play some music and we also highlight the work from the Healthy Aboriginal Network, so stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio proudly co-sponsors the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on Thursday, July 17th from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison. This fundraiser opens with an ocean art show and silent auction, followed by a screening of the surf film Seven Signs. Then the reggaetronic five-piece band Everyday Profits takes center stage at 10 p.m. Again, that's the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on July 17th. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Art Burst Northwest Saturday and Sunday, August 2nd and 3rd at Merrillhurst University. Art Burst Northwest is produced by and for artists, open for all to attend, and celebrating arts and creativity of the region, with the accompaniment of food, music, shaded dining, and lounging in a relaxed outdoor atmosphere. More than 100 Pacific Northwest artists from all media will show their work.
Again, that's Art Burst Northwest Saturday, August 2nd, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, August 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Merrillhurst University, between the cities of Lake Oswego and West Lynn. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.